It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, better abled. There are words we use to describe people whose bodies don't fit the norm. Disabled, differently abled, handicapped. But why do we assume that being blind or deaf or missing limbs is being worse off? In this hour, we'll explore the world of the better abled. Beginning with athlete and fashion model Amy Mullins. She's the owner of more than a dozen pairs of the most fabulous prosthetic legs you can imagine. She calls them her superpowers.
The idea of having superpowers refers to a particular bit of enlightenment I experienced amongst a group of, you know, six-year-olds that I had challenged to come up with anything they could imagine, whether it was a cartoon character, a superhero, you know, an animal, anything they could think of. That if I wanted to be able to jump over a three-story house, what kind of legs would you want to build me? And they were instantaneous in their responses of kangaroos and frogs and Google Gadget and, you know, all sorts of Japanese anime characters that I wasn't even familiar with yet. And immediately a boy said, but wait a second, why wouldn't you want to fly too? And everybody got so excited, including me. And, you know, for me, the poignancy of that experience was the immediate and palpable shift in the way that these children would have been trained to see me, a woman who has to wear prosthetic legs every day, as disabled. That word has a lot of weight to it. And in that instant, I became somebody who was super abled, somebody who had potential in her body that most people don't have. You know, I mean, and we're talking, obviously, theoretically, with jumping over houses and flying, but, you know, we're coming closer and closer to things that 30 years ago were sci-fi TV programs.
We should talk about your running legs, the famous cheetah legs. Can you describe those and tell me something about what it's like to wear them?
Most prosthetics historically always were meant to replicate the loss of a limb, right? So you model the prosthetic off of the flesh and bone leg. Well, if I was trying to be the fastest woman in the world on artificial legs and I didn't have to have human legs, it was like, why are we looking at them? Why aren't we looking at the fastest thing that runs? The idea of having this super energy efficient design in woven carbon fiber that mimicked the way the hind leg of a cheetah worked, and also the way sprinters, you know, sprinters run on the balls of their feet. So when I would switch, I would warm up and train in the shock absorber legs, and then I would switch to the cheetah legs actually to do sprinting or sprinting drills, because it's like, if you were to stand up right now and stand on the balls of your feet, you'd realize you have very little balance. You know, you have to be moving. You know, so hamstrings go into contraction, gluteals, hip flexors, and it was the closest thing we could, as amputees, could experience to the way a sprinter really runs. And also, you know, I mean, I grew up on wooden legs, like a wood plastic compound. So 100% of the energy that I used to take a step was dissipated into the ground. Whereas the human leg, because it's a series of motors and springs, actually gives you almost a 240% return. I mean, it's an incredible thing to think about, that you actually get more energy back from the use of your leg. And this woven carbon foot gives you somewhere around 87% energy return. So you're still losing, you know, at least 10, 15% energy with every step. But it's so much better than what everyone had before.
I've seen you on stage in, I suppose, the legs that give you the greatest height, and you were wearing really stacked high heels also, and I think you said you were 6'1". You make a very beautiful, very imposing presence. Do you find that people respond to you differently depending on which legs you're wearing?
Yes, I do find that they respond differently. You know, it's interesting because even just people that I've known for many, many years who knew me, you know, at a certain height, who knew me at sort of 5'8", 5'9"-ish, and then to suddenly be 6'1", I find that sometimes it's apparent, it's disconcerting for people. Or they've actually been verbal with it, with telling me, gosh, it's just, this is freaking me out. You're so tall.
Well, you tell this great story about meeting a girlfriend once when you first got your really tall legs, and her response was to feel jealous.
Yes, she is stuck at 5'3" or something, you know, and she puts on, of course, she wears some major stacked heels herself, but, you know, she just said to me outright, but you're so tall. said, I know. I said, and it was literally the first night I'd been wearing these. I was out on the town. So I was, it was completely an exploration for me. I was like, wow, I really found that I had to move with momentum, because to slow down in the heels was like, whoa, this is, I'm not used to this yet. And I was just laughing about how much fun this was and how much of an adventure this was and how weird it was to suddenly see the molding of the tops of doors in a different way. And she said, but Amy, that's just, but it's not fair. And, you know, to my surprise, she was serious. She was admitting an envy of that trait. And I have to say, I think it is an enviable trait. I think a lot of people would find the fun in being able to change your height at will.
Still, doesn't it strike you sometimes how very far we've come in this conversation?
I think the shift is nothing short of profound. And it's really been in the last 3 years. For many, many years, Anne, I had to sit through interview after interview and politely grin when somebody keeps referring to me as disabled. It's like, how can you with a straight face look at Brian McKeever, you know, the Canadian skier who is visually impaired and, you know, set the Canadian national record in his sport? How can you sit with a straight face say that person is disabled because of their visual impairment? They're doing something on the same level as other elite athletes in the world. You know, that's quite frankly super ability to me.
You know, we've been talking about reconfiguring how we think of ability. You've also kind of pushed the edge in terms of how we think of what we think about beauty and what it means to be a gorgeous woman. You've also, besides running, you've also wound up working in the fashion world a certain amount of time. You know, you've shared the runway with supermodels like Kate Moss and Naomi Campbell. Your name has shown up on magazine lists of the 10 hottest women in the world. This is also important to you?
You know, it wasn't important to me, but when it happened, I have to say that there was a sense of a real coup for me. You know, I mean, I found it very interesting. There was a photograph by a photographer named Howard Schatz, and it's a black and white photograph, and it was part of a coffee table book he did called Athlete. And he had all the men wear black kind of boxer briefs and the women wearing black kind of Speedo briefs with a black sports bra, with the idea being that black, you know, it neutralizes any bumps that you would see. In other words, he was intentionally trying to take any kind of overt sexuality out of these photographs. He wanted it to be about the beauty of the human body doing these incredible athletic feats. And so it's a photo of me taken in the studio coming out of the starting blocks. And what was interesting was that Sports Illustrated did a feature on me, and they put this photo on their website. And it caused somewhat of a, you know, stir amongst certain feminist bloggers, you know, which was interesting to me because at the time I was the president of the Women's Sports Foundation and, you know, have always considered myself a feminist. And the stir was about this photo being too sexy and that I wasn't being heralded for my athletic achievement or my intellect, but, you know, for basically having a great butt. Which, by the way, I did work very, very hard for. It was like, yes, actually, I kind of appreciate my body being captured on film at the time when I was training this many hours a week. And I found it very interesting because I thought, wow. So I've actually moved up to the level where I can be objectified like any other woman now. How interesting. I've come from the, you know, primordial ooze where it was untouchable to be sexy, right, as a woman missing her limbs mid shin down, and now it's you know, too sexy. I thought, well, that's I'll take that.
Amy Mullins. You can see photos of Amy and those fabulous prosthetic legs on our website at ttbook.org. Now imagine what it would feel like if everywhere you went, people assumed you needed help. If complete strangers insisted on giving you a hand, whether you wanted it or not. Hadar Copley Woods has been trying to figure out how to deal with that for years, ever since she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
I have a pretty wildly fluctuating condition that causes me to, well, sometimes I walk around with no aid, sometimes I need crutches, and sometimes I need a wheelchair.
I mean, how does it affect you from day to day?
Well, it's definitely real and present in my life. It's been slowly, increasingly real and present in my life for about the past 4 years, so I'm relatively new to it. It affects me in that I am most of the time seen as a disabled person by everyone around me.
Did you notice any changes in the way people interact with you when you first started using the crutches and the wheelchair?
Oh, yes. Yes. That is where the unwanted help began.
What do you mean by unwanted help?
Well, if you were to see someone easily and fluidly opening a door and walking through it, you would probably not suddenly panic and say, I'll get that, run over, fling the door open, and then stand in their way. But if the person was in a wheelchair, you just might. You might find yourself doing that. And that's the sort of unwanted help I mean. There's so much of being disabled that genuinely makes me feel helpless, that it's very important to me to be able to do the things that I can do. Very often when I'm in the chair, I will have people run over and push the elevator button for me. But sitting in a wheelchair doesn't actually affect your ability to push an elevator button.
So it's people offering to help and thereby patronizing you that you find actually more irritating than people, say, ignoring you or avoiding you?
You know, there's so much about being disabled that involves society's assumptions that you are helpless and that you need to be an object of charity. I've actually had people come up behind me and grab the back of my chair and start pushing without saying a word, which is really shocking and upsetting. Imagine if you were walking upstairs and someone just thought you needed a boost. Pretty much most people who approach me, assuming that what defines me is what I cannot do, that's emotionally exhausting.
So what do you do when people make these unwanted offers of help?
It depends on the day, and it depends on the person. There have been several times that people, perhaps elderly people, society treats them as if they are helpless. When one of them wants to open a door for me, I am very often extremely gracious because I know they finally are getting the chance to open a door for someone else. Most of the time, I'm not the kind of crip who's going to lecture a stranger. Most of the time, I grit my teeth and I try to be pleasant.
You don't think that people are sometimes simply trying to be kind and just are being very awkward about it?
You saying that reminds me of a time that I remember with keen regret when I was able-bodied. And I was driving down the street. I still remember exactly what street it was. And there was a man in a manual wheelchair struggling against what had been a very sudden snowstorm. And I saw him and I thought, I don't want to insult him by offering help. And I kept driving. And I wish I could go back to that moment and at least pull over and offer to help.
I wonder, how much are these questions talked about in the disability community? I mean, did anybody ever give you advice about how to respond when a stranger grabs your chair?
This is almost constantly discussed. A lot of times we'll just sort of share these stories because sometimes it's hard for someone who isn't disabled to understand how angering an interaction like that can be. And so we'll tell each other and then we'll sort of laugh. And sometimes we will ask for advice. It's very hard based on your personality, based on what region you live in, based on how accessible your town is. It seems like there's a different way to deal with it. Minneapolis is an incredibly accessible town, except for the snow. If you live in some older towns or in towns that do not enforce the ADA quite as well, you might need a lot more help from strangers, maybe to get over curbs and things like that.
Are there ways in which people can offer to help that do work for you?
In my mind, if at all possible, imagining that a person with a disability does not have a disability and just watching for struggle and offering to help seems to make most sense. There have been times when I have definitely needed help if I'm in my wheelchair or in one of those scooters at the drugstore or something, and I need something on a top shelf. There is something that I think binds us together when I ask a person who's just walking along, would you lend me a hand? Would you mind getting down that aspirin for me from the shelf? And they say, sure, and they get it down. And I feel good that someone cared enough to help me when it wasn't their job, and they feel good that they could connect to another person in this way. And I think that is a wonderful way of connecting and of helping each other. When you are genuinely helping people with what they really need, it's part of what makes us human. It's part of how we became human.
It sounds to me like you're somebody who really values your independence. Has it been a challenge to learn how to ask?
Yes, and I think it's really important to almost every American that I know, being independent. For me in particular, I'm an extremely, extremely physical person, and I still am. I still work out probably more than most. I know that my physicality is part of what attracted my spouse, and especially when I first became disabled, that was difficult, not because my husband liked me any less, but because I was afraid that it would change who I was in a really fundamental way. It turns out that it didn't, but I do need to ask for help. And having only been disabled for 4 years, my house is still set up for an able-bodied person. So if I'm having a bad night and I need to be in the wheelchair, I need to ask for help to get almost everything down. Just in basic things, like if I want a drink of water, I need to ask my spouse to get me down a glass. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. And it makes me feel like less of an adult. Even though it's necessary, I really need that drink of water. And then there are times when I'm hit so badly that I need him to help me drag me up the stairs, frankly, so I can get to bed. And asking for that help and then receiving that help from someone with whom you have a sexual relationship, really, that takes some negotiating.
What does he say?
Jan is kind of an amazing person. He is always willing to help. We've had a few moments where I became angry that he didn't anticipate something that I would need. I always need my wheelchair in museums, for instance, and he very kindly loaded the wheelchair into the car for me. And when we got there, I saw that he had not checked the tires, and you really need to fill them every time. And he hadn't done that. And I yelled at him, "Oh, this is so embarrassing to remember." I was just so angry that he hadn't anticipated that need for me. So I've started kind of taking for granted that he's just going to assume certain things. So we're still kind of negotiating those sorts of things.
Is part of the difficulty for you in being able to ask for help that it feels humiliating?
Yes. Yes, it definitely does. I mean, MS is a progressive disease. I'm assuming that I'm going to be needing more and more help, and I hope that we'll be in a financial situation where I can actually hire people to do some of the really, really personal, intimate things that I would just prefer that my spouse didn't do. I feel like having a barrier between those two things will help me to feel as if we're in a more equal relationship, but we might not be able to afford it. He might need to be doing a lot of very intimate, you know, bathing, bathroom kind of things for me as we get older. I'm very nervous about that. I think that when you're in an ongoing relationship with someone, when one person is doing almost all of the helping, it's very hard not to constantly feel beholden. And I still haven't figured out how to negotiate that. And that's a very uncomfortable place to be in.
Sounds like it's a question of grace. How to accept a gift or help with grace.
Yes, I mean, it's very similar to being able to accept a compliment. I've learned how to do that, and so I'm confident that I will learn how to negotiate this with Jan, but so far, I'm still working on it.
Hadar Copley-Woods has been living with MS since 2007. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
It's to the best of our knowledge. Today we're talking about ditching the assumptions encoded in words like handicapped and disabled. We're imagining instead a world in which being blind or deaf or missing limbs might be considered better abled. For instance, writer Stephen Cusisto is blind, which lets him eavesdrop on the rest of us, because most of the time, we don't even notice he's listening.
Maybe it was a Saturday. I remember that my parents were still sleeping. I had a plan and dressed quietly. When I was certain that no one was awake, I slipped from the house. I loved to walk in the woods and follow the beams of light or depths of shade that fell between trees. I remember that on this particular day, I got lost while chasing light and found myself standing in front of the university's horse barn. I knew that somewhere in the cool space before me, a horse was breathing. I stood in the door and listened to him breathe. He sounded like water going down a drain. Then I took one step forward into a pyramid of fragrances. Who would guess that horses sometimes hold their breath? The horse was eyeing me from his corner. Then two cats were talking. Wind pushed forcefully at the high roof. Somewhere up high, a timber groaned. My horse was still holding his breath. When would he breathe again? Come on, boy, breathe for me. Where are you? I heard him rub his flank against a wall. Then I heard him breathe again with a great deflation. He sounded like a fat balloon venting in circles. And then I imitated him with my arm pressed to my mouth. I made great flatulent noises by pressing my lips to my forearm. How do you like that, horse? He snorted. I noticed the ringing of silence. An insect traveled between our bursts of forced air. Sunlight warmed my face. I was standing in a wide sunbeam. I was in the luminous whereabouts of horse. Judging by his breathing, his slow release of air, his sound of a concertina, judging by this, I was nearly beside him. And so I reached out, and there was the great wet fruit of his nose, the velvet bone of his enormous face. And we stood there together for a little while, all alive and all alone. At night, when I couldn't sleep, I thought of this horse. I thought of his glory, his fat sound. I thought of how he pinched the air around him with his breathing. The house and the trees swayed in the night wind. The horse was dry wood talking. He was all nerves and nostrils. He tightened and then unwound. Like a clock, he groaned, like the Finnish women who stood beside the ocean, waving their sticks, strophe and anti-strophe, step, rhythm, pulse beat. I'd crossed a threshold, hearing and walking, the uncertain space that opened before me.
Stephen Cusisto, reading from his memoir, Eavesdropping.
Päivä on kuivatettu, pyykit pyöritetty, pyykit on pyöritetty. Liinat liotettu, liinat on liotettu. Suopa silotettu, suopa on silotettu. Vesi valutettu, vesi on valutettu. Vesi valutettu, vesi on valutettu. Ja liinat on liotettuna.
It's the Finnish group Vartina singing in our studios a couple of years ago. Dame Evelyn Glennie is a Grammy Award-winning solo percussionist and composer. She's got over 20 albums to her credit. She's performed with some of the world's greatest orchestras and with big-name pop artists like
Bjork and Bobby McFerrin. A lot of people consider her one of the greatest percussionists alive today. She's also deaf. Steve Balsam talks with Dame Evelyn Glennie about what she calls touching sound.
How important is touch to music?
Well, we know that to feel and to hear are really the same things. And, you know, there's no such thing as complete silence. I think that only really is experienced when no motion happens, when something is completely static. So probably, possibly, the equivalent of death. I mean, this is why I don't believe there's such a thing as total deafness. I think that, yes, sound may not necessarily be perceived through the ears, but it can certainly be perceived through the body. And of course, to perceive sound through the body and using your body as some sort of resonating chamber, that has to take practice. And, you know, listening skills is about concentration, it's about focus. It's really digesting what is actually going through that body. In the same way that if suddenly you cut off the top or block the top of a marimba resonator or pipe, then the sound doesn't resonate. I'm sure if you covered up, you know, part of the body of a viola or a violin or cello or something, it would be a completely different type of sound, possibly more choked. So we have to open that instrument up. And likewise, our bodies, you know, they are the instrument at the end of the day, and we have to open the body up in order to perceive sound. The great thing about percussion, of course, is that really, you know, the body is often in a very natural position, like a singer, and so the whole body can actually be open physically to perceive the sound. If you think of the posture of a flute player or an oboist or a trombonist or a string player, the body in general is in an unnatural position. So the sound has to go, you know, try to get sort of through all sorts of corners, the way that the arm is bent and held up in the air in order to hold an instrument, this type of thing. And it's more difficult to perceive sound or higher sounds, and certainly in the upper part of the body, I think it's more difficult to digest those, really. And for me personally, that's why I like to work with low sounds, resonant sounds, and that's why a lot of hearing impaired people, young and old, really, really like to delve into those types of sounds coming from timpani or the low end of the marimba or bass drums and things that have huge resonance and low frequencies.
Remember the first time you touched sound, or at least the first time that you were aware that you were touching sound?
Certainly when I began playing percussion from the age of 12, and this was the time when I was really reliant on hearing aids and phonic ears in the classroom, and at that point, I thought that the only way for me to hear better was for everything to be louder. And of course, that was not the case at all. When things became louder, they became more distorted and much more painful and more disorganized, and my balance was affected. My dynamic range was completely affected, and I had no control over what I was doing or that around me. So actually, I discovered that by taking the hearing aids off, that I actually heard less through the ear, but much more through the body. And the body acted like a resonating chamber, really. So this was a hugely important step. And so I had a wonderful percussion teacher at school who also, you know, grew with me. And he had come out with the suggestion of putting my hands on the wall of the practice room or the teaching room, which, you know, this building had very, very thin walls. And lo and behold, you know, you could really feel the sound through your body. There was no question of that. And so we just basically refined that and practiced and became much more aware of what was being perceived. And, you know, that was it. We developed that. So I would say really from about the age of 12 that this awareness came about, and it was really thanks to the vision of my teacher.
It's so fascinating to hear you describe this process, because I think most people would assume that someone who is hearing impaired would have a harder time hearing all these sounds. But I mean, to hear you describe this and to describe all of what you can feel through your touch, it seems like your capacity for hearing is much greater than for most of the rest of us.
I think that the art of listening is something that I'd like to see developed on a much more broad scale in the likes of music institutions. You know, we think of oral training, whereby, you know, we may have to sing back a melody or play back a melody or transpose something or read from a full score or whatever it is. But listening goes beyond that. Those are technical things. But to truly explore the art of listening, I think then the whole body needs to be used and all the senses heightened.
One of the things that's striking about watching you play music is there's often a lot of space within your music, and it seems at times like there's silence sort of in between your notes. But then I guess I wonder if I'm just not hearing the vibrations that you might be feeling as you are sort of letting the music subside before you move on to the next notes.
Well, I don't know, because I don't know what you're actually experiencing, but certainly, you know, it depends on the type of situation. If it's completely solo percussion or if it's percussion with the orchestra, if it's a concerto or something. You know, a good example of this is when you play a snare drum. You can strike a snare drum. We all recognize it as being a snare drum. And we get that initial attack. But we really do miss the life of that sound thereafter. And very rarely do we truly know what a snare drum can do or sound like. So if you strike a drum, just one strike without any other instrument, then there's a whole kind of orchestra of sounds going on, the resonance of the shell, the tuning of the sticks, the tuning of the drum itself, and of course how the hall deals with that sound. If you play exactly the same strike at the same dynamic level and have a tutti chord from the orchestra, you will perceive none of that from the snare drum. You will literally get that initial attack, and all the life of the sound is then completely covered over by the orchestra or ensemble or whatever it may be. So really, there's a lot of that that goes on with percussion. That's why it's very difficult to write a marimba concerto, because the essence of a marimba is, in fact, what happens after you strike it. Once you've struck something, you can't then manipulate the sound. So unlike a stringed instrument or brass or woodwind instrument, you can start a sound and you might say to yourself, oh, I just like that a little bit fatter or a little rounder or thinner or more loving or a bit harder or whatever it may be. And you can subtly change that as you're creating the sound. With percussion, you don't have that option at all. You strike something and that's your lot. So there isn't such a thing as silence, really. There's always sound. That sound is traveling somewhere. It goes somewhere. I don't know where it goes, but it does go somewhere.
One final question. I don't know if you'd be willing to do this or not, but could you play on the table right in front of you, whatever might be sitting there?
Well, I don't know. I am. We do have these paper clips. I don't know. I don't know if you'll be able to pick it up or what.
Would you be willing to try?
We can try something.
Amazing, huh? That's Dame Evelyn Glennie playing an empty tape dispenser, a box of paper clips, a piece of paper, and our audio engineer's keys. Steve Paulson spoke with her. You can see her perform on our website at ttbook.org. And changing the subject, when we come back, we'll celebrate National Poetry Month and check in on what Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk has been reading. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love. Today, Orhan Pamuk, the Nobel Prize-winning author of Snow and My Name is Red.
If you ask me what is the greatest novel ever written, I think it's Anna Karenina. I strongly think that it's a miracle of a novel. Every word of it is miraculously beautiful. I am teaching it at Columbia University to my students, and I always wonder, what's the balance? The book is full of enjoyment of life, its peculiar aspects, little details of life captured with such full force and vitality and convincing crisp quality. And also it's about dramas of human beings, extreme compassion paid even to the little figures or most guilty ones, the writer's desire to produce a whole, the intermingling of the themes, and it's a book of various couple stories followed in comparison. It is also a comparative couples or love stories or marriage stories. And one of the most important things that I always keep in mind, it is about what is important in life, and novels should be about what is important in life. That is love, marriage, friendship, struggle, making money, community, family, history, belonging. Novels should be about that, and Anna Karenina is essentially a glorious, wonderful novel about these issues that takes place in Moscow and St. Petersburg in 1870s. The first sentence is astounding. It's almost people's wisdom in the streets of Russia. All happy families are alike, but all unhappy families are different in their unhappiness, is one of the most memorable openings of a novel. And I read first that in Turkish in 1971. I was 19. I had a picture of him by Repin on my wall 2-3 years later, when I first began to write my first book. Emulate is not a word, but I continue to admire him. You don't have to write much, but you have to write one good book or two good books will save your life.
Orhan Pamuk is the Nobel Prize-winning author of Snow and My Name is Red. You can find more bookmarks and interviews with Orhan Pamuk on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, poetry. April is National Poetry Month, and we're celebrating with a collection of interviews with major American poets. Today, Charles Monroe Kane talks with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Ray Armantrout.
Simple. Complex systems can arise from simple rules. It's not that we want to survive. It's that we've been drugged and made to act as if we do. While all the while the sea breaks and rolls painlessly under, if we're not copying it, we're lonely. Is this the knowledge that demands to be passed down? Time is made from swatches of heaven and hell. If we're not killing it, we're hungry.
Wow, I don't know how many times I've quoted, if we're not killing it, we're hungry. It was my Facebook status update recently.
Really?
Yeah, it's fantastic. It seems a little cynical, though, to me. When I hear the poem again, it seems cynical, but I kind of shake my head at the truth of it. It kind of reminds me of Charles Bukowski, one of my favorite poets. He has the great lines, you know, I wish to weep, but sorrow is stupid. I wish to believe, but belief is a graveyard. You know, he wishes, but he knows. And I'm wondering if you feel that's where you are now, that you wish, but you know.
Well, when I wrote Simple, I thought I was probably dying. And that was quite a while ago, and I haven't died yet. But anyway, from that point of view, when you're thinking that you're dying, life can look like a cruel trick. Do I feel that way now? Well, not exactly. But, I mean, I think life doesn't let you feel that way for long, right?
Right.
Because life is beautiful and desirable and also manipulative and exploitative. So, anyway, I don't think the poem is cynical exactly, because a cynic, in my understanding of the term, a cynic feels above it all and is kind of looking down on something and feeling superior. And I felt very vulnerable at the time of writing it. But of course, you know, I'm still dying. I mean, we're all dying, so.
but dying, to tell our listeners what's happening there, you had cancer.
Yeah.
And a lot of the poems in this book versed grapple with that. How did that affect you as a poet? I mean, you're writing about the world around you, and suddenly the world around you is caving in on you. How did that affect your writing?
Well, it was sort of oddly provocative, because it put me in a very strange place. Things seemed kind of surreal for a while. And whenever something is strange, it makes me want to, as a writer, go towards it and explore it. So I did that. And also, I think probably I thought that as long as I was writing, I wasn't actually dying. As long as I could keep talking, you know, that Scheherazade syndrome. So,
sure.
So there was that. And then, of course, I investigated cancer a little bit. Not a lot, but I read a little bit about it. And it's interesting. So some of the medical terminology and the language about cancer came in, because I always tend to pick up whatever language is around me and kind of absorb it.
You're a writer, and for anyone who's an artist, one of the goals, I would assume, is to leave that mark, right? The thing that lasts beyond your life. You have a great line from one of your poems. I really love it. It says, "Any statement I issue, if particular enough, will prove I was here." Can words really do that? Is that what you were trying to do?
Well, in so many of my poems, I think the real answer is yes and no, or kind of probably not, but we can get closer and closer to it. And I think there's a kind of pathos in the attempt. I was trying to explore, what do we really want from description? Do we want to say something that other people are going to recognize, or do we want to say something unique? Hmm. Probably can't have it both ways.
One thing you do, we're talking about some of these bigger questions, is you really get to the mundane. You'd quote bumper stickers and, and things. I would love if you could read your poem Presto for us as a really
sure.
good example of how you're looking at the modern world.
Okay. Presto. Breaking Anna Nicole news as she buries her son. What do you want to be? Skeleton suits and Superman outfits. Inappropriate touching on drugstore racks. Presto, pairs of flies retie the old knot midair. Blonde wigs and wizard caps. I want to go back. Invisible knot. I want to be that.
When I think about Anna Nicole Smith, that's certainly not someone, you know, I think of in a context of poetry. But when you pull that out of context and put it in poetry, it really gives it some power. You have this great line in one of your other poems that goes, "These temporary credits will no longer be reflected in your next billing period." That sounds like it's just lifted from your telephone bill.
That is exactly right. That's my telephone bill.
That's from your telephone bill?
Yep.
So let me ask you a question. How do you do that? You're a poet. You sit around, you must have a notebook, and you see a bumper sticker, you read your telephone bill, and you say, boom. You write it down in your notebook and put it all together. How does that process go, if you don't mind sharing a little bit of your magic with us?
Well, that's pretty much it. I do keep a blank book journal, and I do make notes. I mean, I guess I was already working on the poem when I got the phone bill. So when I read the phone bill and I came to those rather strange and slightly sinister words.
Yeah, they're kind of ominous.
Yeah, I know. It just seemed to fit the mood of the poem I was working on, so I just put it right in there.
I was wondering if you could read another poem for us. It's on page 11. It's the poem Outer.
Okay. Outer. Dolls as celebrities, Barbie. Celebrities as dolls. I'm the one who can't know if the scraggly old woman putting a gallon of vodka in her shopping cart feels guilty, defiant, or even glamorous as she does so. She may imagine herself as an actress playing an alcoholic in a film. Removal activates glamour? To see yourself as if from the outside, though not as others see you. Carried by light, images remain, while sensation is so evanescent as to be always beyond belief. The outer world means State Farm, donuts, taekwondo, thoughts as spent fuel rods, preceded and followed by statuesque shadows of cacti on a lawn. Today could be described as a retired man humming tunelessly to himself. When I ask what you're thinking, you say, about explaining to children the best way to build a maypole.
Wow, that is a powerful poem. You seemed that you have a faith in words. I'm wondering how you would feel if your human body still existed, but you wake up tomorrow and your faith in words is gone. Where would you be without a faith in those words?
I'm not sure that I do have a real faith that words are describing the world. I mean, the actual world, the real, you know. I think that if we're lucky, words are describing human perceptions and what's accessible through human perception and human culture. But that's not the same thing as getting to the real. I think we're just making sort of stabs in the dark, and we don't know really what we're hitting. I think the only way that we get the sense that something's real is when it surprises us. So then we're outside our own heads for a minute.
I will look for surprises.
Mm.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Would you like to leave us with one more poem?
Sure. Did you have one in mind?
No, whatever you feel led to after all that discussion.
Okay, well, here's one that's always a kind of good for a goodbye. Anchor. Widely expected, if you will, cataclysm. Things I'd say, am saying, to persons no longer present. Yards away, trim junipers make their customary bows. Oh, no thank you to any of it. If you watch me from increasing distance, I am writing this. Always.
That's Rae Armantrout reading from her Pulitzer Prize-winning collection, Versed. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her. And that's what's on our minds today, but you can hear new On Our Minds segments on our website every day at ttbook.org.
All theories like cliches shut to hell. All the small faces looking up, beautiful.
That's one last bit of poetry for National Poetry Month. Norwegian jazz musician Kristin Asbjørnsen's interpretation of a poem by Charles Bukowski, I Wish to Weep. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Raman Tungakar, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music was composed by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.